It's great to see all of you, and in an odd way, I'm happy to see all of you. The reason I'm happy to see so many people here is that in my work over my course of my career as a rabbi that began with my first student pulpit in 1981, I have seen moments of incredible depth and beauty and profound wisdom around death and dying and illness. And I've also seen people die angry. I've seen people around them become numb. I've seen people show sometimes a profound lack of wisdom. And it's not a wisdom that a person can't gain. We're all going to attend to those who are dying, friends and family. We're all going to have to face our own deaths. And of all the things that people take time to learn and master, something like attending to the dying, attending to the ill, facing our own death, is something that people just don't take the time to master this wisdom. And the more we human beings master this wisdom, the more we can be present to each other in these moments. I want to thank Terry for that gracious introduction and for all the work that she's done helping prepare for today and the wonderful host community. I know she's worked with a terrific crew, volunteers and staff. I fear to name one, lest I not name them all. But I just want to just mention in general that Sinai Temple is the gold standard for what a synagogue should be, from your sterling senior rabbi all the way down to those who take care of the facility. So it's a real honor for me to be here at Sinai Temple and work with such a fine organization and be invited to speak here today. So when I think about this topic, personally, I always start with my organizing principle. I find it helps me understand what I'm doing, why I'm doing it. And here's my organizing principle. Every human being has a soul. In the Jewish tradition, we call this the neshama, from the word breath. So every human being has a soul, and in the realm of the soul is where we find ourselves able to connect with what I call the dominant garments of the soul, love and justice and truth and beauty. And when we are faced with any kind of spiritual or moral stress in our life, and so, for example, in today's topic, you find out that you're ill. You've received a terrible prognosis that you're not going to live, that you have months to live, for example. Or someone that you love dearly is facing illness and perhaps is terminal. There's a wisdom that the soul can find within itself, and the wise soul that wants to learn this wisdom will also then be able to seek out wisdom in traditions. There's a tremendous amount of literature, both in their different religious traditions, probably dominantly here, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and so forth. And there's a profound depth of wisdom in the psychological, spiritual world as well. But to decide to go out and read, to decide to go out and study, to decide to be here today, something in your soul says, this is something that I have to master, this is something that I have to think through. So what stops us? What stops us from, number one, finding the wisdom within, and truly knowing how to attend to our own illness, our own death, or the death of another? What stops us from being wise and actually learning those deeper things? So in the Jewish tradition, we see that the human being at a minimal level has two different dimensions. One dimension is that of the soul. The other dimension is that of what we call in general, in English, the ego mind. In the Hasidic tradition, it's called ha'anuchi, the I. And this lower self has fear, anxiety, wants to control things that can't be controlled, grieves in unproductive ways. So try to imagine that in all these moral stresses in life, and especially today, the stress of attending to the dying or facing one's own death, the neshama, the soul, has a wisdom and either knows what to do and can learn what to do. But there's another side of the self that doesn't know what to do and is lost when it confronts the deepest things in life. Now the problem is, if a person does not have some kind of spiritual discipline to stay connected to the realm of the soul, we will default to the ego mind. We will become anxious. We will try to control. We will become numb. We'll try to flee. We'll say the wrong things. We'll do the wrong things. So in the little bit of time I have here this morning, what I want to do is suggest and illustrate and point to what it means to be engaged in that work. There's no way that I or anybody in one session can detail what this is like, but I want to inspire you toward the work. And if you're inspired toward the work, then in our different synagogues, and I think especially a beautiful place like this, then the work can be learned. One can learn how to do this work. When I try to think about the main enemy of being present in the soul, the main enemy of being present in the soul during this time is a default state of a kind of a narcissism. Now, here's what I mean. If you can think of what it means to be present in the soul, and that's a dominating metaphor for attending to one's own death, or the death of another, is being present, is facing things truly, is facing things courageously and honestly, and learning what to do if you don't know what to do, and listening carefully to yourself and others. Because this is such grief-producing work, because it is so difficult, because there are so many defenses to overcome. You have to overcome your grief, your numbness, your desire to flee, your desire to control, that people, in an almost default, inevitable state, are tempted to go back into protecting the ego self. The ego self says, I can't stand this, I gotta get out of here. The ego self says, I'm just gonna say some bromide. I'm gonna say, oh, God's will is mysterious. That'll get me out of trouble here. I have a ready thought to offer in this moment. So what happens is, in these moments, there's almost a stark contrast between being present in the soul and defaulting to a kind of a narcissism. I don't mean this narcissism in a negative psychological way. It's a place where people go. You want to protect yourself. You don't want to feel bad. You don't want to feel anxious. So if we can see these two poles, then you can ask yourself, when you're attending to a grieving person, when you're grieving yourself, if you're facing your own death, are you defaulting toward a sense of protecting the ego mind? Is that what's happening here? Are you coming up with thoughts and feelings and ideas and images that simply help you not feel, not be wise? Or are you breaking out of that prison and trying to be present in the soul? That's the basic struggle that we face. Now I want to share with you just a little bit of how I came to reflect on this work. Terry very generously said that I have some expertise in this. It was not a willing expertise. I wouldn't say it's against my will, it's just simply I stumbled into this work by a curious policy when I was a very junior rabbi up at Stephen Weiss Temple up the hill here. And the policy was, at the time, underpay junior rabbis so they'll go out and hustle weddings and funerals. Right. And what that did is it brought in members and it put us out in the community. We got a lot of on-the-job training. So here I was a junior rabbi, and you know, people would just call the temple. Someone died, we're not affiliated, and as the junior rabbi, you know, there's this, and the pipeline would come down, and the pipeline would come down to my desk, and I was given time to do it, and I find myself at one point, I remember officiating at 4 funerals in one day. Rabbis of large congregations often do that, 9 funerals in one week, sometimes, you know, 60 funerals in a year. And I knew when I began this work, I was not prepared to be present to myself, to the dying, and to grieving families. Although I had the required courses in rabbinical school, let me tell you one of the most embarrassing moments in my life as a rabbi. I was a student rabbi up in Boise, Idaho. I used to fly in once a month for 3 or 4 days. And in my very first visit, I flew in, and the person who picked me up at the airport said, "We have a dying man in the hospital. He wants to see the rabbi." So it's just before Rosh Hashanah, and I had some image in my head that rabbis would go to hospitals with a shofar. You know, people wanted to hear a shofar around Rosh Hashanah. I kind of remembered somewhere. So I had this image of what rabbis do. I thought, well, it can't be what I want to do because, you know, I'm just a second-year rabbinical student. I'm going to do what I think rabbis do. Right? So I come into the room. It's lying there in desperate situation. I walk my shofar and say, "How are you?" "I'm dying." I remember, don't ever ask that question again. That's like the first thing I remember. And I said, "You want to hear the shofar?" He said, "You can throw that damn shofar out the window." He says, "I don't want to hear any damn shofar." So I thought, okay, we've gotten off on the wrong foot, right? So I demonstratively tossed the shofar over on the bed, you know, not out the window, but, you know, and I just remembered who I was. You know, when I was in college, I wrote my senior thesis on Martin Buber. I already at that time I had studied mysticism, and I had and studied the great discipline of what it means to be present in the IU moment. And I realized I just came in and I lost my touch with my you and with the you know, the intimate you-ness of this other person, and I became this thing called a rabbi, and he became a thing called a person in a hospital. And I thought, you know, what just happened? I completely lost myself. So I said, "What's up? What can I do for you?" He said, "You get me a gun." He said, "I can't get a gun." He says, "My lungs have deteriorated. Every breath is painful. My children are all fighting with each other. My life has no meaning. I just want out of here. You wanted to bring me something, bring me a gun." And I sat down next and pulled up the chair and says, "Look, I can't get you a gun. If I could, I might. I get it. But I want to understand what happened. I said, I want you to tell me what happened, because the best thing I can do for you and me right now is to find out what happened and go out there and make sure it doesn't happen again to other people. I said, would you be willing to do this with me?" Now, I remember this man who could barely talk. Every breath was painful. And I was able to sit with him, be completely present to him, and hear his story. Why his kids weren't speaking, why the fighting, why the acrimony, what he did wrong. At this point in his life, he was willing to be completely honest. I could feel this was a tough man with a lot of defenses that were melting right in front of me, because I said to him, "I'm going to be the student rabbi up in here in Boise for a year or two. Don't let this get transferred to another generation. Don't let 40 years or so from now your son be lying in this bed as angry as you are and asking for a gun." I said, "Well, we got to stop this. You got to stop the chain." And so he was able to be present to me. And I remembered in rabbinical school, I heard about this thing called writing an ethical will. I said, "Let me help you write an ethical will." Meaning, what wisdom do you want to bequeath to your children and the world so they're not here in this kind of a place however many years from now? And at that moment, you know, I was probably 26, 27 years old. I think I became a rabbi. That's when I became a rabbi. Because I thought to myself, it's not what the Jewish tradition says. It's not what you learn in school. It's taking whatever you learned in school, whatever the tradition says, and being fully present with another human being, reading that person, understanding their state of mind, and help a person die their way. Don't come in with preconceived solutions. And that first lesson that I learned what we call today a hospice room in Boise, Idaho, it still comes with me today. I remember many, many years later when I was, you know, in that circuit of officiating at so many funerals as a junior rabbi, I remember very distinctly, it's one of those moments, you know, somehow when a moment just defines your life. I remember a man died on January 1st, and I got the call. I was at the people's house by the next day. It's a cold evening out in Encino. I drove up and I stood there, the cold air, I looked at the stars, I looked at the house in front of me, and I had this distinct sense that something that I knew but I had never really, really conceived in my mind, that when I walk into this house, this is the holiest thing I do with my life. The holiest thing I do with my life is to walk in that house with a bereaved mother, a wife and mother, and her bereaved daughters, and walk in there and help them make sense of this, and help them plan, and help them grieve well, and help them move forward, and help them learn the discipline of holy memory, and how not to hurt, and not how not to fall apart, and how not to fall into anger at the deceased man. And every person who dies at some level dies with imperfections, and people can choose, remember the imperfections and stay angry the rest of your life, or learn how to move through that. Or people are angry at God. How could such a beautiful man die so young? Anger at life. I knew I walk into people with such deep grief. And when I think about, by the way, in all these years that I learned this, one way that I understand grief is an attachment to a state of affairs that you can't have back. Now, sometimes people grieve a future. I was going to be this. I was going to have this. I was going to have this job, this relationship, this many kids. This is what I was going to have. And it's been taken from me. And the future that into which you were invested is taken from you, and you're never going to get it back. And people live this desperate alternate life from the one they had planned, and they grieve the rest of their lives. I think of Miss Havisham in Great Expectations. You know, you're all dressed up, ready for this next thing, and you never get it, and you sit in that chair and you mourn the rest of your life. I've met people like that. We were going to go forward in our lives, and they're stuck. Or people who have a sense of what their families were going to be like and what they were going to be like, and it's taken from them. So part of what it means to grieve well is... Thank you. Part of what it means to grieve well is to honor the future that's been denied you. And that's one reason why people don't grieve well, is they feel, if I get over it, if I get over the death of my child, if I get over the death of my spouse, if I get over it, it's as if I didn't honor them. It's as if they weren't so crucial in my life that somehow if I heal from this wound, it means the wound wasn't mortal. So almost in a sense of in a way to honor a person, people refused to grieve well. As if in the trap of grieving, it's a way of honoring. So that one of the skills in grief, as I remember walking into that house, I just thought to myself, people get stuck because not grieving well is in a strange way is honoring the deceased, honoring that future that was denied you. So how do you both honor the future that was denied you? How do you honor the life that you could have had? How do you honor the person that you wanted to live? How do you honor yourself if you're dying? I've sat with people, 37-year-old mother, two children, ravaged by cancer. And she said, it's not right, it's not fair, this is not supposed to happen to 37-year-old moms with two kids. It's not supposed to happen. And my question for her in the few months that she had left, are you going to die angry? Or are you going to be present to your children? What are you going to do here? Now, I'd never say it that starkly, but as a person who's attending to the dying, part of my job is to take their eyes off of the grief, the fury and the anger and the despair and the depression because of the life that has been denied you, and to try to go inside and find the holiness that remains within us. And in the broken lives that remain, can we cobble together some version of a life of nobility and courage and holiness? That's some of the deepest work that we do. Now, in thinking about facing one's death being present to another person, one thing that I have to realize is that people come into this with profound ambivalences. People slide back and forth. So my core work when I attend to a person is to listen carefully and understand their ambivalences. For example, a person might say to me, I'm done. I'm done fighting this disease. I just want out. And the next moment say, I can't leave my children. I have to live. And the next moment say, I'm so furious at my husband because he's numb and he's running. And then say, I've had a beautiful marriage to a good man. And all these things are said. Or I think I attend to people who are grieving. And in their grieving, I'll give you something that's not uncommon. When I'm working with a family of a dying person, is in their grief is not just the grief of losing the person, but the grief of a life not lived well. Of a father dying, and suddenly he realizes he wasn't with his children enough. You know that old saying that when you die, you don't mourn the days you didn't go to the office. Probably one of the things you don't mourn. I didn't spend enough time in the office. That's what people say. They mourn and say, I didn't spend enough time with the people that I love. I didn't spend enough time doing things that I love. So sometimes when I'm with these families, the dying person is just so filled with regret, and the family is filled with anger. We try to help mom, dad, whoever live a better life, and they refuse to do it. They're filled with love and mourning and anger all at the same time. And the worst thing to do that I found is to solve anything. The worst thing that I found is people try to solve it for them. Say, well, nobody's perfect. Or, well, you know, this disease is a great teacher. You know? You ever heard that before? This disease is a great teacher. I said, you know, I would rather have the book version. I'd rather see the movie. So when people say that, I say, yeah, you know, the disease isn't the teacher. Now, by the way, I want to add, If I find that that metaphor works well for a person, I get out of the way and let that metaphor work. I can't stand it myself. But here's what I think. I don't think the disease is the teacher. I think the soul is the teacher. I think God is the teacher. And when one is faced with the disease, you can either face the disease and face one's death with anger and despair, or you can say to yourself, this disease is going to take my life and it's destroying my body, but I'm not going to let it hurt my soul. I am not this disease. It's happening to me. It will not control who I am. If I'm going to die here, I'm going to die with courage and dignity and nobility. And to my dying breath, I'm going to be doing things that I love. I can't do as many things as I used to do, but what I'm going to do, I'm going to do things that I love. And oftentimes, people who recover, go into remission, their lives are utterly different. You know, I have to share with you just personally, I mean, I've been doing this work for many years, but it changed for me. I was dying for about a half an hour at one point in my life. I had a heart attack. And from the moment I had the heart attack to getting to the hospital and being in the operating room, if you've ever had a heart attack, you know, the symptoms are pain in chest and you lose your color, cold sweat, and a feeling of doom. I had the feeling of doom. And on the way to the hospital, my dominant thought was, I've wasted so much time. I've wasted so much time. I haven't been with and done things I love the most. I spent time angry and depressed. I let people get to me. I remember going to the hospital, I think to myself, if I survive this, I'm going to live my life differently. Now, it was one of those things where I survived it. Good doctors, good medical care. It took a year, a strange year, to get used to the idea that I was alive. That feeling of doom didn't go away right away. I felt I had two alternate lives. You know, a couple days after the heart attack, I thought this would be my funeral. And my family sitting Shiva. We're finishing Shloshi. It was a very odd thing. It's as if my soul didn't come right back into my body right away. But I think from having undergone that experience, I understood more deeply what it's like to have that sense of doom. And to live with coronary heart disease, you know, as my physician told me, it doesn't get better. You can slow it down, it doesn't get better. And I don't know how much time you have. You can do a bypass, right? There's things we can do. I have to tell you, it's changed the way that I live. It's changed the way that I think. It's changed my passions. It's changed what I do with my time, how I relate to people. I have so much more patience for some people and so little patience with others. There are some conversations where I just said, you know, we're stopping this conversation. Not true, not honest, not righteous. I got better things to do with ever how many minutes I got left, and this isn't one of them. And there are other people that are deep and true and beautiful and wonderful, really holy things to talk about or work through, I got time for that. I got plenty of time for that. Because that's the truest thing you can do with your life, other than cultivate one's connection with the divine, is to be true and present and righteous with other people. It's shaped the way that I think. It's shaped the way that I'm a rabbi. I remember one person in particular. Many years ago, a person called me, not a member of my synagogue, called me and said, I heard you speak a couple of years ago. I need to talk to you. And I had an ethical dilemma because she's a member of another congregation. I said, you know, I'm not really supposed to be attending. She says, you know what? I'm dying. Don't worry about that. I'll handle that. I just need to talk to you. I said, okay. She came to my synagogue over lunch, and she came in with her IV hooked up. Very frail, woman in her 50s, striking. You could tell that when she weighed more, really a stunningly beautiful person, physically beautiful. And I sat down with her, and she said, I would have never have chosen this disease. And she said, this disease hasn't taught me anything. She said, but I've learned, she said, I don't know where this wisdom came from, I've learned how to die. She says, I'm dying. And she says, I need to tell someone, and I need to tell you, I think you'll understand. And she said, I finally learned love. She says, you don't know me. She said, I was manipulative, I was controlling, I was focused in the physical world, She said, you would not have liked the person that I was a year ago. You would not have liked me. She said, I liked myself. I liked how I was in the world. She said, but I wasn't a true person. And she said to me, as I'm facing my death, and by the way, she was almost translucent in the cancer and in the frailty. She says, in this time that I'm facing my death, I've learned truly to love. Not trying to control anybody, without expecting anything. It's as if a part of my heart became so beautifully and wonderfully present. She says, I wouldn't choose this disease. I wish I'd been wise enough to learn this differently. She says, I want you to know this. She says, because I want you to teach other people. Don't wait until your death to be a true and righteous person. And I remember sitting there. I could barely contain myself. With the depth and truth of the moment. You know, she'll always exist. I don't remember her name. I just call her the translucent woman. A light shone through her. And I remember sitting and thinking to myself, this is one of the holiest moments of my life. Just sitting here and being a witness to another person sharing with me this passion for righteousness and truth and honesty, and at the core of it, love. Just please tell other people. And I thought of all those homes that I've been in, all those grieving people, and all the moments of truth that came out of that experience. I remember one person in particular in preparing for a funeral. A man passes away, the family gathers around. You know, what I tell people is, look, we're going to try to do something honorable, but I need to know the truth. I won't say everything you say, but I don't want to be dishonest. So tell me as much as you can, and then we'll craft the most honorable way to say it. So people sometimes have an image of a funeral as you lie. You just kind of say the nicest things possible. Well, part of what a funeral is, the first step in the grieving process, and by the grieving process, I mean learning how to grieve well. Then the family gathering before the funeral can be the first moment in grieving well, where the deepest and truest things that we can come up with are said, and an able clergy person or officiant at a funeral can then find a way to get through the service, but the service is not the point of that meeting from my perspective. The service is important, but the point of that meeting is for people to begin a grieving process that, by the way, for many of them, will go on the rest of their life. You don't stop grieving after Shiva. You don't stop grieving after Shloshim. You don't after the 7-day and the 30-day period. Those are rituals that will be talked about later today by other people that will help you get through a little bit. But you're grieving the rest of your life. And the way that you are during the period before the funeral and the funeral and the Shiva, 7 days, and the 30, and the unveiling, all of these set up the spiritual discipline of how to mourn well. And I remember I was sitting there with the widowed mother, two daughters, and the uncle, the brother of the deceased man. And as we're talking about it, and cousins, which means the uncle's children were there as well, the two daughters say, Dad never said he loved us. And the mother says, oh, you know he loved you. He didn't need to say it. Daughter says, he did need to say it. Mom says, you know, you don't need to say those things. And the daughter said, Mom, would you knock it off? You defended Dad his whole life. He's dead now. Stop it. Dad made a mistake. He didn't show us enough love. So the rabbi doesn't have to talk about it at the funeral, but we're going to say the truth here. Uncle chimes in. You don't need to say those things. Everybody takes it for granted. His kids say to him, I'm sitting there feeling the holiness descend. His kids say to him, you're the same way, Dad. You don't tell us you love us. He said, don't need to say those things. Everybody knows it, takes it for granted. And I looked at the kids, I gave them a look, and I said, go for it. Go for it. And his kids, these are kids in their 40s, look at him and say, you have to tell us that you love us. Sitting in a chair, they're all on the couch here, and I looked across the room at a 73-year-old man who had just lost his brother. And I saw him have to make a decision. And really, in a way, it's the decision that every one of us has to make. Who am I? Not what to do, not what the halacha says, not what the technique in the book says. You read all that stuff, you imbibe it, you ingest it, so you'll have at least some form, some law for the grace of the moment. And I was looking at him, I thought, okay, here's the moment. Here's the moment. He came apart. He came apart. All the defenses, defense against feeling, against the hurt, against disappointment with himself and his brother, and distance from the kids and another, it all came apart, and he just let it out. And he talked about how much he loved them, and he loved his nieces and nephews, and he loved his brother, and how things had gone wrong, he doesn't understand it. And I could feel the family begin to heal. Because he was able to break through and be present and true. And the healing began in that room, right in front of me. All because I knew, when I come into that room of the Bree family, my job, be present, be true, be honest. We'll put a funeral together, but you gotta be true here. Because if you can't be true here, you can never be true. If you can't be true in the presence of a death, you can't ever be true. And as I, of course, then helped them process through it, helped the man, met with the man later, it just reaffirmed to me what can happen around death, what can happen around illness, if we're willing to be brave and courageous and true. Two more images. There's another man in my memory. I don't remember his name. He was just the angry man. And he stands for, not the people who are angry at the deceased or the dying person angry at other people. This is a man who is truly angry at God. And I was a young rabbi, probably in my mid-30s. Man came to me about my age. I'm 54. I look back and he's probably just my age. And he said to me, 3 years ago I had everything. Now I have nothing. He said, I heard you give a talk, a sermon on a Friday night. You seem like a true person. I need to talk to you. I said, okay. He says, just promise me one thing. I said, what? He says, you're not going to give me that damn book. Okay. So there was a while back where people were handing out, what was it called? Harold Kushner's book? Why? No, it was actually why. It was when. Yeah, when bad things happen to good people. He says, every rabbi I talk to pulls that out like candy. He says, the book didn't touch me, I read it. But everybody just hands me that book. And I learned a lesson there. I said, okay, tell me the story. So, Bekitzur, compressed version, he had two children, a son and a daughter. The son was mildly mentally disabled and lived in a care facility, used a hot plate, caused a fire, and died in the fire. His daughter, younger, who had every gift her brother lacked, couldn't stand the guilt and committed suicide. Their marriage was not strong enough to stand it. She left. He said, I'm Job. You know, I sat there, I thought, nothing in my formation as a person or my training has prepared me for this moment. And I remember thinking to myself, I have to find the truest thing within me that I maybe have never even arrived at. And by the way, at that moment, I remember it distinctly, I knew I was a Kabbalist. I'll tell you why. Why I teach Kabbalah. Kabbalah, what I call the deepest spiritual psychology of the Kabbalah, putting all the red strings and everything else aside, the deep spiritual psychology of Kabbalah says, we live in a broken world. There's been a shattering out of which our world came. And each human being bears our own personal copy of that shattered world within. And our life's work is to discover the configuration of our shattered world within, try to bring it together, try to heal it. If we can be present to other people and help them overcome their shattered world, then we should. And in this way, we heal the divine. So we live in a shattered world. Good people die young. The wicked sometimes prosper. Why? Because we live in a shattered world. And I said, many of us, I was in the military, so I used a military, he was in the military as a young man, and I was also in the military as a young man, so I used a military image. So, you know, a lot of people spend life in the supply company. They live their life in a warehouse. And other guys are on the front line. They're getting shot at, their friends die, they get maimed. And you're living your life, most of us live our life in the supply company. By the way, I learned later from all my years, very few people live their whole life in the warehouse, in the supply company, just moving stuff around. So I said, you got drafted to the front lines. You got thrown into battle. So what happens when you get thrown into battle and you get shot and your buddies are getting killed, people are maimed? Do you say, the war against the darkness, the shattered world, isn't worth it. I'm running from here. Is that what you say? You see, other people, the dying, the bereaved, they're on the front line facing that darkness. That 37-year-old mom with two kids, she's on the front line. She was dying. And I said to her, you can die depressed and angry, and that's what your kids will remember, or you can die with light and courage. It's up to you. You can go either way. The cancer doesn't determine how you're going to die. It determines that you will die. It does not determine how you die. You can choose how you die. Now, I said this more gently, but that was a basic point of it. And I looked at this man and I said, I don't have an explanation. I don't have a reason. I don't have a program other than I know this. We live in a broken world where horrible and grievous things happen to good people. And our job as human beings is to bring some kind of healing in the midst of sometimes the most terrible brokenness. Our urge is to run. Our urge is to go AWOL. Our urge is to say, I can't stand this battle. I want out of here. And then I think from the point of view of Jewish mysticism, that's why I teach Jewish mysticism, is there something profound and deep and holy at stake. Your spiritual identity as a human being. Who are you? Are you a person of courage and dignity and nobility? Can you suffer well? Can you suffer wisely? Can you be present to yourself and other people? What kind of person are you? And if you're not that person yet, you learn to become that person. The Jewish tradition is filled with resources on how to become that person. I didn't start out as that person. But I had the will to become that person. I found the text and the teachers helped me become that person. So you can become that person. I said, or you can be shattered and depressed and angry and walk around in an utterly broken state until some disease or accident takes your life. I said, no, this was 2 hours that I spent with him until we came to that point. I said, I don't have an explanation, but I do have a vision of what it means to be a human being. And when we left, I realized that I had a theory. It was deep inside me. I didn't know it was there until Job came to me and said, tell me something. And I had to find it within. And it's governed my life ever since then. It's a governing principle of my life. We have a soul within us that either has or can find the wisdom to help us live lives, not whole lives, because I don't think that's possible, but lives of greater healing. We can do that. And if you don't know exactly how to do it, if you have the will to do it, you can find the means to do it. That's what I learned from that moment. So just one last thing before I take a few questions, if you have them. When I think about the Kaddish, you know, it's one of those prayers that's very, very misunderstood in our tradition. You've probably heard the Kaddish says nothing about death. It's true. The Kaddish originally was spoken when people studied non-legal material and they got up and said, Yitgadal v'yitgadash shmi rabbah. May the holy name, may the great name expand in holiness, etc., etc., etc. People would say, May it be blessed forever. And the person reciting would say, it's great, holy, wonderful, splendid, exalted, and so on and so forth. And then the reciter would say, Le'ela min kol birchata v'shirata tushbechata v'nechamata. And it's beyond every song, blessing, praise, or sermon that could ever be delivered in the whole world. We say, Amen. Now, in a traditional service, when do people say the Kaddish? Have you ever gone to a traditional Saturday morning service, let's say? Every time we finish a piece of liturgy, we say the Kaddish. I remember people thinking, wow, this Kaddish is... You know, we do Pesukei Zimra, say the Kaddish. Then we say this section, say the Kaddish. And read the Torah, say the Kaddish. And finish the Torah, say the Kaddish. Kaddish is everywhere. And you know, I was ordained in a Reformed seminary, and one thing the Reformers did in the beginning, a terrible mistake, let's take out all the Kaddishes, let's take out all the repetition. They forgot the point of the Kaddish. You say a set of prayers, and then you say, we still didn't get it. Le'ela, it's beyond everything we just said. So one can say, well, it's beyond everything we say, why say it? I just be quiet. That's also true. You could just be quiet in the awe, but the Jewish tradition says, you know what? We can never get it fully. We can never say it fully, but you try to say it fully. And in that aspiration to say the truth, some holiness occurs, and then we say, but it's beyond that too. So what happened was, how do you become the mourner's Kaddish? That the mourners, in my mind, were the ones who had the most difficult time saying, the holy name is expanding in holiness at all times. They're the ones that were tempted to say, there is no holiness. There's no righteousness. There's no truth. So what do we say? Well, after we do a little bit of studying, you, who just suffered the terrible loss, you get up and lead us in the Kaddish. And then that person had to get up and say, Gadal, Yit Gadash, painfully. I know that even in this great moment of grief and tragedy, the holy name is pushing itself through. And it's beyond anything that anybody here can say. But I know that the great name is expanding in holiness and pushing itself into this moment right here. Hence, the mourner's Kaddish. That's one reason the mourners say that. I'm convinced one reason to say the mourners say the Kaddish is because the student said, we can't say it with you sitting there. You got to lead us in it. And if you can lead us in it, you can get us there. So when we think about what part of what mourning is, part of what grieving well is, the wonderful metaphor of the Kaddish for me is even in the times of the deepest grief where we want to control, we want to run, we want to say silly, superficial things, if you can just remember, Yit Gadal V'Yit Kaddash Shemir Rabba, the holy presence is expanding continuously and into this moment. And I have to find the way to say the holiest and true thing. Even if the holiest and true thing to do is to sit here and be quiet and simply be present to another human being. Thank you very much.